Chapter 2. The fog swirled over the heads of the marching men. A London fog, thick, yellow, metallic on the tongue. I couldn't see the head of the column, only the swinging lantern carried by the leader. This 6:30 a.m. walk to breakfast was just about the worst part of the day, when my morale was low and thoughts of home rose painfully. We used to have fogs in Garraby, but they were country fogs, different from this. One morning I drove out on my rounds with the headlights blazing against the grey curtain ahead, seeing nothing from my tight-shut box. But I was heading up the dale, climbing steadily with the engine pulling against the rising ground. Then, quite suddenly, the fog thinned to a shimmering silvery mist and was gone. And there above the pool, the sun was dazzling, and the long green line of the fells rose before me, thrusting exultantly into a sky of summer blue. Spellbound, I drove upwards into the bright splendour, staring through the windscreen as though I had never seen it all before. The bronze of the dead bracken spilling down the grassy flanks of the hills, the dark smudges of trees, the grey farmhouses and the endless pattern of walls creeping to the heather above. I was in a rush as usual, but I had to stop. I pulled up in a gateway. Sam jumped out and we went through into a field, and as the beagles scampered over the glittering turf, I stood in the warm sunshine, amid the melting frost, and looked back at the dark, damp blanket which blotted out the low country, but left this jewelled world above it. And, gulping the sweet air, I gazed about me gratefully, at the clean, green land where I worked and made my living. I could have stayed there, wandering round, watching Sam exploring with waving tail, nosing into the shady corners where the sun had not reached, and the ground was iron hard, and the rime thick and crisp on the grass. But I had an appointment to keep, and no ordinary one. It was with a peer of the realm. Reluctantly, I got back into the car. I was due to start Lord Halton's tuberculin test at 9:30 a.m., and as I drove round the back of the Elizabethan mansion to the farm buildings nearby, I felt a pang of misgiving. There were no animals in sight. There was only a man in tattered blue dungarees hammering busily at a makeshift crush at the exit to the fold yard. He turned round when he saw me and waved his hammer. As I approached, I looked wonderingly at the slight figure, with the soft, fairish hair falling over his brow, at the holed cardigan and muck-encrusted Wellingtons. You would have expected him to say, "Now then, Mr. Harriet, I was through this morning." But he didn't. He said, "Harriet, my dear chap, I'm most frightfully sorry, but I'm very much afraid we're not quite ready for you." And he began to fumble with his tobacco pouch. William George Henry Augustus, 11th Marquess of Halton, always had a pipe in his mouth, and he was invariably either filling it, cleaning it out with a metal reaming tool, or trying to light it. I had never seen him actually smoking it. And at times of stress, he attempted to do everything at once. He was obviously embarrassed by his lack of preparedness, and when he saw me glance involuntarily at my watch, he grew more agitated, pulling his pipe from his mouth and putting it back in again, tucking the hammer under his arm, rummaging in a large box of matches. I gazed across to the rising ground beyond the farm buildings. Far off on the horizon, I could make out tiny figures, galloping beasts, scurrying men, and faint sounds came down to me of barking dogs, irritated bellowings, and shrill cries of, "Whoa, whoa, get her by! Sit down, dog!" I sighed. It was the old story. Even the Yorkshire aristocracy seemed to share this carefree attitude to time. His lordship clearly sensed my feelings because his discomfort increased. "Oh, it's too bad of me, old chap," he said, spraying a few matchsticks around and dropping flakes of tobacco on the stone flags. "I did promise to be ready for 9:30, but those blasted animals just won't cooperate." I managed to smile. "Oh, never mind, Lord Halton. They seem to be getting them down the hill now, and I'm not in such a panic this morning, anyhow." "Splendid. Splendid!" He attempted to ignite a towering mound of dark flake which sputtered feebly, then toppled over the edge of his pipe. "And come and see this. I've been rigging up a crush. We'll dry them in here, and we'll really have them. Remember we had a spot of bother last time, huh?" I nodded. I did remember. Lord Halton had only about 30 suckling cows, but it had taken a 3-hour rodeo to test them. I looked doubtfully at the rickety structure of planks and corrugated iron. It would be interesting to see how he'd coped with the moorland cattle. I didn't mean to rub it in, but again I glanced unthinkingly at my watch, and the little man winced as though he had received a blow. "Damn it!" he burst out. "What are they doing over there? I'll tell you what, I'll go and give him a hand." Distractedly, he began to change hammer, pouch, pipe, and matches from hand to hand, dropping them and picking them up, before finally deciding to put the hammer down and stuff the rest into his pockets. He went off at a steady trot, and I thought, as I had done so often, that there couldn't be many noblemen in England like him. If I had been a marquis, I felt, I would still have been in bed, or perhaps just parting the curtains and peering out to see what kind of day it was. But Lord Halton worked all the time, just about as hard as any of his men. One morning I arrived to find him at the supremely mundane task of plugging muck, standing on a manure heap, hurling steaming forkfuls onto a cart. And he always dressed in rags. I suppose he must have had more orthodox items in his wardrobe, but I never saw them. Even his tobacco was the great smoke of the ordinary farmer, Redbreast Flake. My musings were interrupted by the thunder of hooves and wild cries. The Halton herd was approaching. Within minutes the foldyard was filled with milling creatures, steam rising in rolling clouds from their bodies. The Marquis appeared round the corner of the buildings at a gallop. "Right, Charlie," he yelled. "Let the first one into the crush." Panting with anticipation, he stood by the nailed boards as the men inside opened the yard gate. He didn't have to wait long. A shaggy red monster catapulted from the interior, appeared briefly in the narrow passage, then emerged at about 50 miles an hour from the other end with portions of his lordship's creation dangling from his horns and neck. The rest of the herd pounded close behind.
"Stop them! Stop them!"
screamed the little peer. But it was of no avail. A hairy torrent flooded through the opening, and in no time at all the herd was legging it back to the highland in a wild stampede. The men followed them, and within a few moments Lord Halton and I were standing there, just as before, watching the tiny figures on the skyline, listening to the distant,
"Oh! Get a bye!"
"I say," he murmured despondently. "Didn't work terribly well, did it?"
But he was made of stern stuff. Seizing his hammer, he began to bang away with undiminished enthusiasm, and by the time the beast returned, the crush was rebuilt, and a stout iron bar pushed across the front to prevent further breakouts. It seemed to solve the problem, because the first cow, confronted by the bar, stood quietly, and I was able to clip the hair on her neck through an opening between the planks. Lord Halton, in high good humour, settled down on an upturned oil drum with my testing book on his knee.
"I'll do the writing for you," he cried. "Fire away, old chap."
I poised my calipers. 8-8. He wrote it down, and the next cow came in. 8-8, I said, and he bowed his head again. The third cow arrived. 8-8. And the fourth. 8-8. His lordship looked up from the book and passed a weary hand across his forehead.
"Harriet, dear boy, can't you vary it a bit? I'm beginning to lose interest."